Hi, welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through every Newbery Medal winning book and then we talk about it. I'm Michael.
And I'm Rebecca.
And this time we are talking about the 1981 Newbery Medal winning book, Jacob Have I Loved by Katherine Patterson. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about this book, but also we'll be talking about what we read recently, and then we'll be talking about what we're going to read next time. Rebecca, what have you read recently?
I want our readers to recognize, and Michael O'Malley to recognize.
Our readers or listeners?
Our listeners, who are also readers, many of them.
Definitely. I don't know why you would listen to this podcast if you didn't read.
but I mean, a lot of them are reading along. But I would just like to comment that my book list is very short. And will you notice how quick the turnaround is between this episode and the Westing game?
That's true.
I prioritized this book, which was very good. But spoiler alert. So
I also want to say I still finished it first.
A day before. Regardless, the books that I have read since we last chatted with you all is Yellow Face by R.F. Kuang. I was on a waiting list for this book for a long time, and let me tell you guys,
worth the wait.
It was worth it. This book had me hooked from the very beginning. I don't want to give away a lot because I went into this book not knowing anything about it. Like, I did not know the plot. I did not know what it was about. I just knew that, like, it was on a list of need to be read books. That's not what they're called. But anyway, it was on a lot of lists, you guys. And it was a bestseller. But what I will say is this book is very damning of the publishing world in very healthy, good ways. I don't want to give away a lot, but you should read it. It is a book of fiction about a woman, and the whole book is written from this woman's perspective. It's about a woman whose friend dies, and she basically steals her novel and puts her own name on it. And what is super problematic about that, not that that in and of itself is not problematic, but what is even more problematic is she is a white woman who has stolen this story from an Asian woman, and this whole book is about Chinese laborers during the war. So, anyway.
What war?
Oh, I don't remember.
A war. They had a few of those.
It's not important.
Around China.
Anyway, it is so good. And anyway, that book was just fantastic. I also read If Bill Street Could Talk by James Baldwin. Michael and I saw that movie when it came out a couple years ago. The book was very good. It's a very beautiful book. I did really enjoy it. I was telling Michael that there are parts of it that's hard for me to read because the whole book is written from the main character, Tish, who is a woman's perspective. And it's written, she's telling the story of how her boyfriend gets wrongfully accused of rape and is thrown into jail. In the midst of, she finds out after he's put in jail that she's pregnant. So it's telling their love story, but it's also telling this larger story about his imprisonment and her worry about her baby. There are some scenes that are difficult for me to read just because they are scenes that are told from a woman's perspective about sex, but they're written by a man, and it just feels kind of icky to me, but also this book was written a long time ago, so let's also take that into effect. But the book is very good. It's a very lyrical book, very beautiful. I'm glad I read it. I also read How the Light Gets In by Louise Penny, which is number 9 in the Inspector Gamache series. If you listened to our last episode, you know that the last Louise Penny novel I read, I was very disappointed in. This was the complete opposite in all of the best ways. It was very, very good. I'm not going to give anything away, but it was just a fantastic book. I read The Girl with the Louding Voice by Abby Daré. I think is how you say her name. This book was also very good. It was recommended to me by a friend, and it is the story of a young girl who is living in Africa, and she's forced into an arranged marriage with an older man, and then is sent to be a servant in a house where she is abused. And it's really, and all she wants to do is to go to school and be educated and make a life of her own. And it's really just her journey of persistence and resilience to get to her end goal. So that is what I have read. I am reading a few different things right now because I picked up books when I had started other books, which I don't normally do. So I don't want to talk about all those ones that I have not gotten far into, but I do just want to say that I am rereading Little Women right now, and it is truly wonderful. And if you listened to our episode way back when where we talked about The Invincible Louisa, that was maybe like, what, our third episode or something?
It was pretty early on in the podcast.
Yeah. You know that I'm a huge Louisa May Alcott fan, a huge Little Women fan. I'm rereading this because I was recommended a podcast from another podcast. Michael and I are very avid listeners, avid followers of this podcast called Strong Willed with Crispin and D.L. Mayfield. And D.L. was telling us about a podcast called Joe's Boys, which is rereading Little Women through a queer literary criticism lens. And so they're reading each chapter and unpacking it and also telling a lot about Louisa's life and just life in Boston at that time. And it is deeply wonderful. And I was like, I just need to reread the book with them and read along with them. So I'm doing that, and it's wonderful. And if Michael's mom is listening to this, don't listen to either of those podcasts. You won't like them. But anyway, I'm getting a lot out of rereading Little Women. So, over to you.
Over to me. I've read fewer things, as always. I did finish Bel Canto. I know everyone was on pins and needles after our last podcast. What is Michael going to think about the ending of Bel Canto? Well, I like the ending of Bel Canto. It's very sad. But also, it has this thing that sometimes stories do where you have these kind of unlikely communities and unlikely utopias kind of form, and they're like a bubble, right? And you kind of wait for the bubble to burst because you know that's going to be the tragedy of the story. And that's kind of what happens in this kind of improbable way in this hostage situation in Bel Canto. And the way that it all works out is very beautiful, but also very sad. Also sad, I did not get more into the backstories of the guerrillas who had created the hostage situation, but that's okay. Still good. Still a good book. I will probably read more Ann Patchett books eventually. The other two books I've read. One, I'm about to teach a unit to my students who are seniors in high school about Shakespeare's Othello, and so I hadn't read the book in a while, like 10 or 15 years. And so I reread Othello, and, you know, it's Shakespeare. It's good. I remember it being good. I still like it. For those of you who haven't read or seen an Othello adaptation, it's about this guy named Othello, who's like a general, and he's a Moor in a European society. I think it's Italy. Being a Moor, he's kind of an outsider. And he marries this this white woman named Desdemona, and also promotes this guy named is it Cassius? Gosh, I gotta get these names right before I actually teach this. But he promotes this guy into a high position while also marrying Desdemona, and this makes two people very mad. It's Cassio, sorry. The first person it makes mad is this guy named Rodrigo, who wanted to marry Desdemona, but didn't. And then the other guy it makes mad is Iago, who is like Othello's right-hand man and was jockeying for that position that Cassio got, but Othello didn't give it to him. And so Iago, like, basically creates this, like, conspiracy plot to... Like, first he instigates Rodrigo to cause problems and get jealous of Othello. And secondly, he starts to make Othello think that Desdemona is cheating on him with Cassio. And so it's a Shakespearean tragedy. So by the end, lots of people have died. You know, the nature of human relationships has been plumbed in very ornate and poetic language. It's good. The second book that I read is called Junkie. It's by William S. Burroughs. And longtime listeners of the podcast may remember that maybe about a year ago, I read another William S. Burroughs book called Naked Lunch. And Naked Lunch was a wild book. Junkie is also kind of a wild book, but not in the same way. So Naked Lunch is super surreal, super, like, you know, obscene. You know, in fact, it was, like, the center of one of the last, like, consequential obscenity trials in the United States. Whereas Junkie actually is fairly realistic and not surreal, not especially obscene, but still about kind of illicit content, because the premise of it is it's like a lightly fictionalized, you know, heavily autobiographical work by William S. Burroughs about, like, how he fell into, like, heroin addiction. And so, you know, it starts about with him, you know, kind of recounting his life, like, getting into college and things like that, and then how he, you know, eventually fell into first dealing heroin and then using it himself. And then all the kind of misadventures and kind of suffering that follows because of that. And it's not very surreal at all. It's not very dreamlike. I was kind of expecting going into this that there would be a lot of, like, he's high on heroin and, you know, we have these, like, kind of dream sequences or whatever. There's really hardly any of that. And most of it is about, like, very, like, material realities of, like, well, we ran out of smack, so then I had to go buy the smack. I only had $10, though, and so then I had to go do this thing to buy $10 or to get $10 more. But then the smack I bought was, you know, not very good, so I had to combine it with this codeine, and, like, it's a lot of that sort of stuff. And it's good. It is definitely not what I expected, having read Naked Lunch. The reason I read it is that there's a movie coming out called Queer in a few months, maybe, or soon. And this is an adaptation of another William S. Burroughs novel, also called Queer. And this book, Queer, involves a character that's in Junkie. So I'm like, well, I should read Junkie. William S. Burroughs, of course, and then I'll read Queer next. William S. Burroughs, of course, is also a very gay man. In addition to being, you know, kind of notoriously addicted to heroin.
How's one very gay, as opposed to...
I mean, that's, like, gay. A big part of his persona, okay. Is, like, he's, like, at a time when a lot of people were not openly homosexual, like, he was.
Right.
And kind of, like, a lot of that kind of, that beat generation, you know, it was about flouting norms and things like that. But he also became kind of, like, a icon of, like, queer literature and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I've not read Queer yet. I'm curious if it goes back to that kind of, you know, really hallucinogenic style that is in Naked Lunch, or if it's more of this, you know, really kind of gritty realism that Junkie is. I think it's about him in Mexico City. I think it's like a continuation of, like, his, you know, pseudo-autobiographical stuff. But maybe, I don't know, I haven't read it yet. So that's what I've been reading.
Real quick, before I talk about the author, the war was World War I.
Okay. In Yellowface?
Yes. That the book was about in Yellowface. And the girl with the louding voice is about a girl from Nigeria. I shouldn't have just said Africa. He's from Nigeria. So, anyway,
cool.
Just want to get that.
I will also say that our dishwasher's been running, and I think the mic is picking it up. So, I hope people find
Sorry,
that soothing.
Guys.
Maybe it's like ASMR. We should start doing, like, hello, podcast listeners.
Don't do that.
Okay.
I hate that so much.
Rebecca's not an ASMR
fan. I
can't
stand it.
Anyway.
The only people that can do that is NPR, and they don't even whisper that much.
They're like accidental in ASMR.
Soothing. Okay, anyway. Let's talk about Catherine Patterson.
Yeah, tell us about old Kathy.
So Catherine's about to have a birthday, you guys. She was born on Halloween in 1932.
Spooky.
So she will be 92 on October 31st of this month. She's won 2 Newbery medals. Her most famous one was for Bridge to Terabithia. It will be hard for me to not talk about this book in this podcast. I will try to save all of that for when we get to read that.
Which was in the 70s, right? So it won't be a while. It will be a while until you can loop back around to it.
I would just say I love that book. Michael and I have both read it. It's a great book. And for Jacob Have I Loved, which we're talking about today, she was also given the honor for the great Gilly Hopkins. She's also received the National Book Award, the Hans Christian Andersen Award, the Astrid Lindgren Award, and the Laura Ingalls Wilder Medal, among other awards. But all those big, like, literary ones for children's literature, she's got them all. She was actually born in China. Her parents were Presbyterian missionaries there. And when she was five, they fled China when the Japanese invaded in 1937. And they returned to the U.S. at the beginning of World War II. They lived in Virginia, North Carolina, West Virginia, kind of all over Appalachia. And they moved 15 times over 13 years.
Whew, sounds Lord. Terrible.
They eventually settled in a town in Virginia. Patterson's first language was Chinese. So when she moved to the U.S., she had difficulty initially reading and writing English. Which is amazing to me. Like, I mean, I know anyone can learn. Anyone can learn a language. And the way that Katherine Patterson has, like, such control over the English language is one of her, like, biggest gifts. But I say that, and I've read many authors in which English was not their first language, and they are not, you know, their parents did not speak English, and they're, like, Solito is one that I read this year, like that his use of prose and language is just astounding.
It's just one of the most incredible feats, like Nabokov or like Joseph Conrad or like people like that, like who, I don't know, as a monolingual speaker and reader,
it's very humbling.
I'm very humbled.
But anyway, she graduated from her undergrad from King College, which is now King University in Bristol, Tennessee. She spent a year teaching at a rural elementary school in Virginia, which a lot of her books are either like influenced by her time in China or in Japanese or in rural Appalachia. So again, I'm not going to talk a lot about Bridget Terabithia, but when we get to that book, we'll probably skip the author's bio since we're doing it now. So I just want to share this quick story. She based the character Jesse Ahrens in Bridget Terabithia off of her time at the school. And what was really sweet is when she published that book, she was no longer teaching anymore. But a teacher in Virginia read that book to her class, and one of the students was like, "My mom was in her class when she was a teacher," and I just thought that was so sweet. Anyway, that was on her her author page. That was on Wikipedia.
Okay.
Anyway, she received her master's with some type of Bible degree from the Presbyterian School of Christian Education in Richmond, Virginia. And her goal is she wanted to become a missionary in China like her parents, but its borders were closed. And so her friends really encouraged her to go to Japan. This was really hard for her because she had always seen the Japanese as the enemy, the ones that were bombing her home and of her friends. Obviously, she grew up during World War II, which all of that, that was very common to have that bias there. But she did go to Japan, and she ended up really falling in love with the people, falling in love with the culture, which I also said influenced her writing later on. But when she was in the U.S. for a year studying, she was not intending to stay here, but she fell in love with John Patterson, who lived in New York, and she ended up staying in the U.S. But she had every intention of spending the rest of her life in Japan as a missionary.
So how long was she a missionary in Japan?
I don't know. I don't know how long she was there.
Okay.
She started writing curriculum for 5th and 6th graders in the Presbyterian Church in 1964. You know who else writes curriculum for 5th and 6th grade children at church?
Is it Rebecca?
It's me.
Oh, wow.
Anyway.
So she was writing Sunday school curriculum like for a school?
For Sunday school.
Okay.
Basically. Anyway, so like many of our female Newbery writers and winners, she started writing fiction in the throes of motherhood. She had 4 kids in 4 years.
Oof.
God bless her. And she has said when she started writing, she wasn't very good. She couldn't get anything published. She couldn't really, like, figure out how to do it, but she really wanted to write fiction. She didn't want to write nonfiction anymore. So one of her sweet friends helped her figure out childcare and everything within motherhood in order to go to this writing class once a week. And after that, her first book, The Sign of the Chrysanthemum, was published in 1973. So, and I've already talked about her awards and some of her big books, but most of her writing involves children who are orphaned or estranged and who only have a few friends and face these really difficult situations largely on their own. And people have said this might reflect her own childhood in which she felt very lonely and isolated. Her books typically tackle themes of triumph through self-sacrifice, death, and jealousy, which was not common of YA books at the time when she was writing them. And she writes with compassion and empathy, as well as dry wit and humor. And I just want to note that I think I've read 3 of her books, to my knowledge, and the ones that I remember most distinctly are obviously this one because I just finished it, and Bridge to Terabithia. And I just think it's very ironic that a woman who grew up as an MK, lived her life as a missionary, like as a very devoted Christian Presbyterian church, could write about these characters, these main characters with deep religious questions and doubts. Like when I think about Leslie, Jesse Aaron's friend in Bridge to Terabithia, like that's what's most stark to him is that she can say, like, I don't believe in a God who would damn people to hell. And she has this character who feels so, which you're going to talk about the book.
This character, meaning the main character.
Sarah
of,
Louise.
Yeah.
And Jacob Have I Loved. That can feel so rejected by God and can say, I don't believe in him. I don't want to follow him. Like I just think that that speaks volumes that she can have that deep faith and also give her character space to have these deep doubts, which she's probably had herself. We have no way of knowing that, but I'm just saying I don't think you can write with such empathy without having asked those questions yourself, you know. Anyway, yeah, that's her life. You want to talk about this book?
Yeah, sure. So speaking of kids who feel alienated and lonely, Jacob Have I Loved is a book told through the perspective of a girl named Sarah Louise, although a lot of her family calls her Wheeze as a nickname, which I think is kind of cute, but she really hates because she feels like it's patronizing.
And they call her that because her twin sister couldn't pronounce her name when she was little and called her Wheeze, and
it's like a Beezus Ramona sort of situation. But anyway, so she, in this book, Sarah Louise they're living in this small little island that's like just off the coast of Maryland, and it's like a crabbing community. Like that's what everyone does. It's a very small provincial place. Her dad is a crabber, you know, people live in this island generations. This island seems to have a population of like 50 or something. Like it's very small. It's set during, like, the majority of the book is set during, like, the late 30s and early 40s, because at some point we get, like, World War II happens and that sort of thing. But that's not the main plot of the book. The main plot is Sarah Louise is actually a twin with her sister Caroline. And they were both born, obviously, being twins at the same time, but when Sarah Louise was born, she was fine, but then when Caroline was born, they were really worried about her, and she was, had to immediately be, you know, have medical treatment when she was born, and so the family always kind of laughs about, like, oh yeah, we just forgot about Sarah Louise, because she was just in the bassinet, you know, and that is kind of like a microcosm of how Sarah Louise feels about her whole life, which is that everyone is paying all this attention to Caroline, who turns out to be this beautiful singer, who ends up going to Juilliard, and, like, you know, later on in the book and all this sort of stuff, whereas Sarah Louise is this person who is really dependable and people don't have to worry about, but also they don't think about her that much as a result. So the book is kind of like, in some ways, the title of the book comes from the Bible, and in some ways this is a biblical story that's similar to Jacob and Esau, which in the Bible, you know, you might know as like Jacob and Esau are twins. Esau's born first, but Jacob is favored by his mother and like basically swindles Esau out of like his inheritance or his birthright. And so there's like all this tension between them. And the community, the island that they live on, is this heavily religious community. Sarah Louise's grandmother lives with them, and this is a very religious woman. And so the Bible comes up constantly in this book. You know, so like, it's not just like incidental and it's named Jacob Have I Loved. It's like constantly ruminated on. And as a result, like Sarah Louise becomes fairly bitter about religion because she feels like she sees the parallels between her and her sister and Jacob and Esau. And she reads in the Bible about how even God favored Jacob. And she feels like, well, God doesn't care about me. My family doesn't care about me. And she becomes this very bitter person.
And not just God doesn't care about me, but he made me. Thinking this about me from the very beginning. Like, yes. He intended me to live this life where Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. And I am hated, not only by my grandmother and my family, but also by God.
Right. And so the book covers, like, basically, it seems like probably, like, most of the book covers maybe 7 or 8 years of Sarah Louise's life or something like that, until the very end when it kind of skips forward in time quite a bit. But we see her grow up, like as a schoolgirl, and then she starts working more with her father, crabbing. She has a friend whose name is McCall, but she just calls him Call. And he eventually, as he gets older, goes off to World War II as a soldier. Like I already mentioned, her sister goes off to Juilliard to study music, paid for by... basically a wealthy heiress on the island, and this is
not
a little
heiress.
Yeah.
Heir.
No, it's an heiress because Aunt Judy. So there's a woman on the island who's like an old spinster, basically, and she's inherited a lot of money from her father who died and left her all this money. This woman gets into poor health because she's getting older and is married by this guy whose name is Hiram, but everyone calls him the captain. And the captain has befriended these children. And he's kind of come back to the island after having lived a life outside of the island. And he, basically out of kindness, because he wants to care for this woman, everyone calls her Aunt, is it Trudy?
Trudy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Aunt Trudy. Everyone calls this old spinster Aunt Trudy. He marries Aunt Trudy out of kindness so he can take care of her, and it's not improper that it's a man living with a woman.
Well, also, his house has been swept away by hurricanes.
Yeah,
so he
also
needs a
that.
Place to live.
But then when Trudy dies, she, you know, the captain gets all the money, and the captain says, I'm going to pay for Caroline's schooling with this money, because I don't want people to think that I married this woman for her money. So that's a subplot. Another subplot in the book is that the island is slowly dissolving into the ocean, because I don't know what this island is made of, but it is not made of strong enough stuff to withstand storms. And so, like, every time a hurricane or another storm comes through, a little piece of the island falls away. And so, literally, like, the walls are closing in on Sarah Louise as she's on this island. She's just feeling very trapped and very embittered. Even, like, the adults that she cares about, like, her mother and her father and the captain, like, all seem to kind of take her for granted and favor Caroline over her. And eventually she gets really angry and has a big confrontation with her mother, who is not native to that island, came to the island, and she, like, confronts the mother about, like, why did you even come here? Like, why would you waste your life coming to this stupid island where everyone's trapped here? And they have a really beautiful, meaningful exchange that I'm sure we can get to later on. But what comes out of that is that Sarah Louise feels finally like she's made a connection with her mother, and her mother basically tells her, you don't have to stay on this island. You know, if you leave, we will miss you, but you should also leave if that's something that you want to do. And that the fact that the mother articulates that to her is really meaningful. And so this is the end of the book. This is probably like the last 15 pages or something of the book. She goes and becomes a nurse. Initially, she wants to be a doctor, but all these soldiers are coming home from the war and are getting the GI Bill, and she's basically told there's no chance for a woman to become a doctor with all these men trying to become doctors. So Sarah Louise becomes a nurse instead, and then goes and becomes like a nurse in like a rural Appalachian town in, is it in West Virginia?
She ends up in West Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a way, kind of doing the same arc as her mother, who, you know, kind of came to this small crabbing village. She comes to the small Appalachian town and is like a nurse there. And she eventually...
And a midwife.
And a midwife, right? Specifically a midwife. That's what she studied as midwifery. And the book ends with her giving birth to twins.
No, she didn't give birth to them.
No. I mean, she delivers twins.
Yes.
Yeah. Right? The book ends with her delivering twins who have a kind of similar situation as when she was born, where one of the twins requires all this medical attention, and she makes sure that the other twin is paid attention to and cared for as well. And that's how the book ends. So what do you like about this book, Rebecca?
Well, I'm just going to tell you guys, I'm probably going to cry when we're talking about this book. Because number one, if you're not listening to this in time, like, we're recording this right after the devastating hurricane that kind of, like, wiped out, like, towns and communities really close to us. So, like, reading this book, while all that has happened, and it's like, we are completely fine. But places just 30 minutes away from us are not, you know, 45 minutes and an hour away from us. Asheville is devastated. Our pastor was, like, stuck there this weekend, and she's back and okay. But it's just, like, reading this while watching their island fall apart and things change was just, it was just kind of like hit really close to home. But what I love about this book, it is a very moving story with beautiful prose and really deep, rich insight. And I'm just going to read one sentence that kind of like captures that. This is when like Sarah Louise has, like her mom has basically given her permission to leave. She doesn't have to stay here. And she says, I was too grateful for that one word that allowed me at last to leave the island and begin to build myself as a soul, separate from the long, long shadow of my twin. And so this book is just full of beautiful insight like that, just told so perfectly. Like, I think Katherine Patterson has such a way with, like, putting into words the deep, darkest feelings that we feel in our lonely nights of the soul, you know, like those times where no one else understands what we're feeling or why we would feel this, or it, she just puts it into words so perfectly and captures all of those emotions in a way that leaves you to feel deep empathy for these characters that you were often frustrated with the way that they might be acting or perceiving things. So speaking of that, you have this deep empathy with Sarah Louise throughout the book because it's told from her perspective. Is it a first-person narrator?
Yeah.
So it is told from her perspective. But you also have this frustration with her limited perspective that you can see as, like, I think...
Well, in the narration seems to be her as an adult retrospectively, like,
yes,
reflecting. So she'll, like, say things like, I didn't understand why I was feeling this at the time, or I don't know why I said this because it wasn't helpful, but...
But she will bring you still back to that moment. Like, you
right.
don't feel out of touch with, like, those scenes, even if she's telling them as, like, an older adult. So this is definitely a coming-of-age story. But anyway, so you have this frustration with her sometimes of, like, I don't really think those characters mean that, or, you know, they're not intending to be this way. And sometimes they are. We'll talk about that grandmother. But anyway. Like, she has a deep, I wouldn't call it hatred, but she has, like, deep disdain for her sister. And sometimes her sister's doing things which you're just like, I don't really think that she's trying to do anything negatively towards you, but I understand how that negatively impacted you. Or I don't really think anybody's making you make these decisions, but I see how you feel that. So you have this, like, deep understanding of where her feelings are coming from, but also, like, as a reader, you can be like, maybe there's another way. And so you have this deep empathy with her. And then when characters say to her exactly what you've been thinking the whole time, like the captain, Hiram Wallace, that Michael was talking about, says to her at one point, like, you don't have to stay here. Her mom says, you don't have to stay here. Nobody's keeping you back. Like, there are decisions that you can make here. What do you want? And someone asks her that, and she's like, I do have desires. I do have, you know, that are not just reactionary. Like, I have deep longings inside of me that I did know I had permission to voice. And so, anyway, like, I just think her ability to, like, weave all that together so intricately is truly wonderful. I think there is this deep empathy with, like, sorry, I've used that word so much, but there's this deep understanding of, and I feel that this is especially true for women and daughters, is being told that you can be everything, but when that everything that people are talking about is usually something they're praising that's more than motherhood. So you kind of grow up with this, like, what do you want to be? Who do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to do? And you have these big dreams, and people don't expect you to say, I want to be a mother, because they want to know something more than that. But then you do that thing, and if you do become a mother, like, it feels like those two things are in conflict. And you can look at your own parent and feel like, did you accomplish everything that I was told I could be? And sometimes feeling that tension of, like, it needs to be this or this. And motherhood is this thing that is so much lower than all these other things you could be. But also, you're a woman, so you should want it. And, like, just that tension there, like, growing and watching Sarah Louise look at her mom and be like, and it's not so much just motherhood for her. It's also that, like, in being a mother and being married to her dad, she then lives with her grandmother, who is not a nice person, and is also
an evil woman.
And is also evil. Also, you see her, like, her mental health just deteriorating throughout the book. And when her mental health deteriorates, she's very confused at her surroundings, and she is very mean. She calls her mother a whore. Like, she will read scripture
well, to
her as a
whore. Well, she eventually becomes confused and thinks that the mother is like some trollop that the father has picked up in town.
Yes.
And
That thinks that she has stolen, the grandmother thinks that the mom has stolen the grandmother's partner from her.
Right.
Like,
it's very
confused.
It's kind of implied, she never says it, but it's kind of implied that the mother feels obligated to care for this woman and live
right.
with this woman because of her position married to
right.
Sarah Louise's dad. And I think that that's like an sorry, I know this is your
it's
time,
okay.
but like one subplot I didn't talk about, which isn't really a plot as much as it's just like a ongoing like tension in the book, is that like Sarah Louise is expected to marry and whatever, and she has never expressed that she wants to get married, but then by the time that everyone's starting to get married and she's not, she's disappointed that she's not part of that too.
Or even
and
just
so,
going to college, like continuing her education.
Right.
Which, and her mother is a teacher. So her mother, like, Sarah Louise gets in a place where she's helping her dad, like, with crabbing, and like, she's just kind of, like, dropped out of school, and her mom's, like, her mom and dad are both, like, no, you're really smart. Like, you love school. We want you to continue your education, but also you're really helpful to me now that Carl has gone off to war, who is her best friend and was also crabbing with her dad.
And who comes back from war and ends up marrying Caroline, which
yes.
is, like, a real salt in the wound kind of
yes.
moment. And that's when she realizes that, like, I don't even know if I wanted to be married to him, but seeing my sister get married and my friend marrying her makes me feel more alone and like I should have been pursuing these things. But then I look at my mother and how miserable her life seems, and I don't want to be like that either.
Right. And so that scene really comes to a head when her grandmother is just at the peak of her nastiness to her mom. And she can see that it's like her mom, she's very frustrated with her mom because she's like, why is she putting up with this? Her grandmother has also just hit her with the Bible when Sarah Louise quoted back to her, like
physically hit
her. Rather a person live on
the... it's like that verse in Proverbs that's like better to, I don't remember, I'm paraphrasing, it's like better to live in a trash heap than with a contentious woman or something.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
So her grandmother just hit her with the Bible and her mom's just like, hey, why don't we go wash the windows? Even though they don't need to wash the windows, but they know that their grandmother won't come outside because she doesn't like being outside. And so Sarah Louise is like watching her mom just kind of be crestfallen. And she's like, you're so smart. You could have done anything. Like, you left. Her mom wanted to go to Paris, she finds out.
Paris
and write poetry. And she ended up marrying her dad and staying on this island. And Sarah Louise is, like, hitting the house. Like, why in the world? God in heaven, why did you choose this? And it's just, I'm sorry, guys. It's like her mom tells her, you don't have to do this. Like, you don't have to make the same choice that I did. It was my choice to stay on the island, and I don't regret my life. I don't regret the life that I chose in being married to your dad and having you and your sister. Gosh, guys. And it's just this beautiful scene between them. And also, I will say, I think me more than Michael had a little bit of empathy for the grandmother, too. It's like you find out...
I have zero empathy for the grandmother.
Okay. But this woman is not in a healthy place, and she's trapped on an island where she hates water. She's fearful every day of her life. She's very confused at her surroundings, and she and Sarah Louise have these moments where Sarah Louise feels like, okay, have a little bit of insight into why you are the way that you are. But I will say, what we are seeing happen to Sarah Louise in her formative years is emotional abuse from this grandmother. Like, her grandmother is the one.
And also the grandmother is not, like, senile the whole time. Like, she's clearly, like, a very embittered and antagonistic woman from the beginning.
I disagree. I think she is senile from the beginning, but we see her deteriorate. Because the family already from the beginning is like, oh, grandma, like, you know. Anyway, I think that's another gift that Catherine Patterson has of capturing, like, this duty and loyalty that you have to your family to care for one another in sickness and health. And also, sometimes that's a really nasty, horrible-looking thing in which people are miserable. I will say, it is very difficult to watch Sarah Louise experience this as a child. Like, it's hard to watch the parents experience this, but it is even harder to watch this happen to Sarah Louise.
Well, because also the parents are very passive. Because they're...
Yes.
If, like, for instance, there's multiple times when the grandmother is saying really nasty things, basically accusing the captain who has kind of befriended Sarah Louise, like, basically accusing him of being a pedophile.
Yeah.
And the parents don't say anything to her. They don't say anything to Sarah Louise. They just are like, Sarah Louise, leave the room or whatever.
They do often send the girls away to try to handle grandma and, like, bring them back. But, like, Sarah Louise's grandmother is the one that tells her about this Bible verse. That she, like, whispers it in her ear. Like, it just, ugh, guys, it makes me cry. But she, like, whispers in her ear, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. When the grandmother perceives that Sarah is feeling very isolated because of accomplishments that Caroline is having. So the grandmother is playing off of all of her insecurities in a very abusive way,
well,
in which the grandma has knowledge of what she's doing. So
and
let me
it's ironic, too, because, like, of all the family members, the grandmother seems to understand Sarah Louise the best, but uses that to torment her rather than, like, you know, like, I think a lot of the family doesn't quite realize interiorly what Sarah Louise is feeling, but the grandmother seems to feel it the whole time and uses it as, like, a weapon.
Yeah. And so I think Catherine Patterson really captures this isolation that you can feel within your family, but also this inexplicable tie and loyalty that you have to them. And, like, Sarah Louise's deep desire to leave, but also, like, what would I do without them? Like, who am I without them? Like, they need me, and they do need her. Her parents really do need her. But anyway, and just also the last thing I'll say is I already hinted at this a little bit, but I do think the way that she captures religious trauma And the loneliness and isolation you can feel within a context that someone has told you is God's will, like those parts just, they just make me weep when I think about it, because I really do think she captures those feelings very exactly. And so anyway, I'm going to give you a chance to talk, but those are the things that okay. I liked.
I mean, I agree with a lot of the things that you've said. And one thing I'll point out is, not specifically about this book, but it's been kind of interesting to read these Newbery books, like, and kind of over the decades, and seeing, like, how, like, what we can classify as children's literature has changed over time. And I'm bringing this up right now because I think that, like, a kind of interesting thing about this book is how much of a raw nerve it is. Like, it's very, like, intense. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly written for, like, older readers, maybe even teens or whatever. I mean, if this were published now, I think it would, without question, be published as YA, which typically doesn't win in Newbery now. Like, YA, over the last, like, maybe 2 or 3 decades, has become kind of a separate publishing niche than, like, what we would say is children's literature, which is what the Newbery deals with. And I think that, like, I mean, this book talks about sex. This book, like, talks about, like, puberty. And then there's also, like, the just very intense emotions, you know, the main character is allowed to be, you know, very, like, very harsh about her family, you know, will, like, just say how much she hates her sister. And, like, there's not a reconciliatory moment with her sister in the book, really. She gets peace with who she is compared to who her sister is. Mm-hmm. But there's not, like, a moment, like, a book that I think you could compare to this is, like, the, Beezus and Ramona book that Beverly Cleary wrote, which is also about, like, sisters' conflict and, like, one of the sisters feeling really intense feelings of dislike for her younger sister and just not knowing how to deal with that. But, like, that book does come to a moment of reconciliation. It's much more lighthearted because it's, you know, the subject matter is not as intense, but it's also, like, the audience for that book is not for audiences who are feeling, like genuine, like, trauma over, like, these familial relationships. Whereas, like, this book is, I think, really admirably plumbing these, like, intense, you know, difficult emotional terrains, and in a way that I think is not typical of children's literature as we classify it now. Like, if you want to see something like this, you have to go to adult literature or YA or something. And I think it can be really meaningful in this context. I don't know, not that kids can't deal with intense things, but, like, I like the way this is kind of a fluid novel. Like, by the end, and we can talk about the ending later on, but, like, by the end is basically become, like, adult fiction. Like, very briefly at the end, as she's, like, an adult living in, you know, West Virginia or whatever. And there's, like, a fluidity in, like, what this book is and who it's speaking to. Like, it feels like it's speaking to different levels of readers, depending on what stage of life they're talking about for Sarah Louise. And in each case, it's, like, allowed to be really honest and tough. And for the most part, doesn't rely on pat answers for it. Like, a lot of this stuff simply is not resolved, and Sarah Louise has to wrestle with it internally rather than have reconciled. Like, for instance, like, her friend Call goes off and marries her sister Carolyn, and basically never shows up in the book ever again. Like, she references him a few times. She references her sister Caroline, who's living in New York City, by the end. But there's not, like, a moment where they have peace. Like, what has to happen is the protagonist has to grow in an interior way. And that, it's, like, exclusively interiorly that she has to grow with relation to her family for the most part. Like, one really kind of tough and tragic thing at the end of the book is that her dad dies. And she can't go to her dad's funeral because she's pregnant, like, very pregnant, like, about to give birth to her own child, and is in the middle of West Virginia and can't take that trip. And so her husband has to go in her stead. And, like...
And her sister gets to go.
And, you know, the book is just full of things like that where it's just really... The way it wrestles with these questions just feels really genuine and honest and accessible, but also not willing to just kind of rest on its laurels of, like, well, this is how a story would normally treat this. this is the kind of scene that the story would normally place here. And I think that there's like a lot of stuff in this book that's really surprising. Like, for instance, her relationship with the captain is really interesting mm-hmm. because, like, her and Call, like, seek him out. And initially, you know, it's Sarah Louise is really intrigued by this guy because they don't know who he is and all this sort of stuff. She kind of, like, half entertains the idea that he might be, like a German spy or something like that. But it, eventually it just comes out that he's, like, an islander who's returning home after having been, you know, gone for, you know, most of his life. And her relationship with him gets really complicated because, like, she starts to hit puberty and starts to become, like, attracted to him. Like, sometimes children who are, like, going through puberty feel about adults. They feel weird, like, kind of sexual feelings about adults, and that really confuses her. But also, she starts to see the ways that he starts to connect to Call more than she can connect to him. And part of that is because of her kind of reluctance to be open, and he doesn't seem to understand her relationship with Caroline and her family. But also part of it is just that, like, you know, he seems to be more in tune with, like, who the person that Call is, whereas she is, like, not, she doesn't make that same connection. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that never really works itself out. Like, she has scenes with the captain later on, and they still are, like, friends and on good terms, but she has to wrestle with the fact that, like, well, he ended up being closer to Call. He ended up paying for my sister's schooling, and
based on a comment she made, based that on the a captain comment, thought she was recommending.
Yeah, and she has to come to terms with this person that I thought was maybe my window to a different life is someone who is simply just another person in my life that I have to care for and, yes, be a friend with, but also is not going to be this kind of magical relationship where everything is going to be, you know, perfect, and, you know, it can't be her own little world. You know, it can't, it's another thing that her sister is a part of, and it can't be her own thing. And the book never does anything to mitigate that. She has to learn to live with it. And there's just a lot of hard stuff in the book that's like that. I think it's really cool. So I agree with all the stuff you said. That's what I would add.
Yeah. In terms of what I disliked, I don't know. I feel like Sarah Louise is, like, pretty hateful to Call most of the book. And he makes this comment at one point of, like, well, you never really did think I was worth anything. And she, I think what she's feeling is devastation that that's what he thought and devastation that that's how she treated him. But she, that's one of those things that never gets addressed. She just kind of runs away and never denies that that's true. And it just left me sad that, like, she actually really cared for him, but, like, didn't know how to communicate that. Or, like, maybe, I also think she's not had that model for her, like, how you treat people kind of because of what she's been through.
I actually really like it, though, because for a lot of the book, he's, like, almost comic relief because I think this might even be the first chapter of the book where she's trying to tell him jokes and he doesn't get the jokes. And, like, that's kind of, like, a running thread throughout the book is, like, he's this very, you know, practical, you know, literal-minded person who doesn't get, like, her kind of more poetic
insights. I just wish she could have had a scene with him kind of like the one she had with her mom where she was, like, no, I think that you're everything. That's why this is so hard that you're marrying my sister, because I thought, you know, you were my person and not hers. Like, I thought, and I think what's also, this is something that I like also, I think what's really ironic throughout this is Caroline was kind of separate from her life with the captain and with Call until Sarah Louise kind of invited her into that. And when she invited her into that, Caroline becomes this, like, looming presence that Sarah Louise doesn't know how to grapple with, and then Sarah Louise kind of pulls away, and then she just kind of, like, sees, which is just so hard, and I know what that's like, that feeling of, like, I don't really belong here, but I want to belong, but I don't know how,
right.
And also, so I'm going to let this other person overshadow all of it when I actually do have agency. I just don't know how to.
Well, and also I'm bitter about the situation, and my bitterness is making the situation worse, but I don't know how not to be bitter.
And then they end up getting married. So it's just like this deep irony that's actually really good, but I did wish they could have had some kind of resolution.
But I like the fact that, like, what I meant was, by bringing up the comic relief element is that, like, I think a lot of times in stories, like, comic relief characters are just kind of relegated to this purgatory of not being quite real characters mm-hmm. because we're supposed to be laughing at them. And, like, by the end of the book, Hall has kind of, like, come into his own mm-hmm. and kind of recognized, and not in a hateful way, but it's just kind of organically grown out of the fact that, like, Sarah Louise clearly cares about him, but also has treated him like he's inferior. And it's just a natural outgrowth of that, that he's going to bond with the people who don't treat him like that, like the captain or Caroline.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Sarah Louise starts to feel left out of that is a direct result of the way that the book kind of introduces mm-hmm. their relationship. And it just makes a lot of sense that it happens that way, although yeah. it is sad. I agree.
Well, and I think this is where we'll spend the rest of our conversation is with the ending.
The ending's a mess, I gotta say.
The ending is a mess, and you know what? The critics agree. I think that...
What do you mean the critics agree?
Well, I just want to read this one quote. But, like, So the ending is very rushed.
So by the ending... Here's what... When you say the ending, this is what I think.
Okay.
The scene with her mother happens where her mother says, like, you don't have to live this way. And then after that, it immediately jumps to, oh, I went to school and then went... That's what I would say is the ending, is after the conversation with her mother. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. So yeah. when she goes to University of Kentucky, she really wants to be a doctor. Her goal is to, like, be a midwife in these isolated areas, like, really build up her practice to where, like, she can't be denied. That's another thing, is when she's in college, she's told, like, you can't be a doctor because you're a woman. Like, our men are coming back from war and they're going to be filling up these roles. We really just need you to be a nurse. We need you to change your degree. So she leaves that school and goes somewhere else. And then she gets this midwifery job. And she's basically, her goal is, like, to make herself, like, essential to them, to where they have to, like, make her a doctor. But she ends up really becoming invested in this Appalachian community and feeling very essential there, and falls in love with one of her patients' fathers because he reminds her of her dad from this one... But anyway, we'll get to that.
This is over the course of like 10 pages.
We'll get to that. Yeah, so it's all kind of rushed, and she gets this ending, which I think it is a happy ending, but it's also like... You have this sense of, like, she's becoming her mother. And, like, this is the scene, this is the life she didn't want. But, like, she's practicing what she wants. And instead of being isolated on this island, she's isolated in the mountains. And, anyway, all of that feels very rushed. And I just want to read this one quote about that. So, sorry. It says the... Kirkus Review said this. Nope, that's not the one I want to read. Sorry. This literary critic, Zena Sutherland, wrote, "The story has a logical but rather speeded happy ending, but this minor flaw does not keep Jacob Have I Loved from being an unforgettable book." And I do agree with that. That is how I would say it. But this other person, the Kirkus Review, says, "Patterson has to get into Louise's later years to make the point and to avoid the instant realizations that substitute in too many juvenile novels. However, this tends to flatten the tone and blur the shape of the novel. Louise's earlier intense feelings evoke recognition and sympathy, but this hasn't the resonant clarity of Bridget Terabithia or the great Gilly Hopkins." And I would agree with both of those things. I don't think that she had to go that far into Sarah Louise's life. Like, she doesn't have time to do that because the very rich material is, like, in her title. I think you can have a coming-of-age novel and it end like another beautiful coming-of-age novel that I was just talking about, Irene Hunt's Up Road Slowly, like, end with her going to college. Like, yeah. And write a sequel if you want to talk about the rest of her
life. So, actually, it's funny you bring that up because, like, I have this exact same problem with the ending. But I think that the idea of the ending is really beautiful and poetic. Like, her becoming...
With the twins, yes.
With the twins, but I think also, like, her becoming like her mother.
Yeah.
Because she does not understand why her mother would choose a life like this.
Right.
But Sarah Louise falls into a life like that through following what she cares about and has mm-hmm. found a very meaningful existence in mm-hmm. basically doing something just like her mother did.
Yes, I agree.
The idea of that is very... But it's so rushed. And what it feels like, what it feels like is a book that I have not read, but you just talked about, is Little Women. How Little Women, the story that we now know as Little Women, is actually two different books that usually are published together, where a lot of the early goings of Little Women are, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in the details, a lot of the early goings of Little Women that are about Louise, or not Louise, Jo's childhood.
Mm-hmm. Not just Jo, all her sisters.
All of the Little Women's childhood. That's like book one. And then book two is kind of like when Jo is becoming a writer.
It's called Good Wives.
Right. And, yeah. And like as they grow up. And this book feels like it's wanting to do something like that, but it squishes it all. I don't know.
That's why I'm saying write a sequel. End with her going to college and then tell the rest of the story.
I think this could also be a book that, even if it weren't a sequel, if this were a longer book and didn't have a, in particular, like a juvenile audience in mind,
mm-hmm.
I think this could be kind of like a richer, kind of like almost Jane Eyre type story,
yeah.
You know, where you have this kind of much longer tale of like someone who grows up, like, and we see a lot of her childhood, mm-hmm. but then we also see a good portion of her adulthood too. Like,
yeah, it could just be a longer book. I agree.
Yeah, and I think that like you have two options, is to either end the book after her conversation with her mother and she leaves the island, which is a really good ending to the book, I think.
Yes.
Or substantially build out the stuff after she leaves the island. But right now, we're left with this kind of really, I feel like, it feels like a SparkNotes summary mm-hmm. of what the rest of the book would be.
Here's the other complaint that I have, and it's like a complaint with a question mark. It's like, I didn't grow up in Appalachia. I kind of live here now. Like, I've worked with a lot of families who have grown up here. Like, you know, did this ending have a tone of, like, bias against Appalachians to you? Like, kind of judgmental
See,
in a way?
So she you're talking about how she talks about how
on our island we didn't
drink at all, but
right.
all these Appalachian men are like bootleggers and drink and all that sort of stuff and beat their wives. I don't know, because I'm A, not a native of Appalachia, but B, I don't know anything about the like fishing communities. Like
mm-hmm.
if, let's say I knew these fishing communities, and I knew that it was like an overly romanticized version of a fishing, like crabbing community and an overly critical view of Appalachia, I would agree that I just don't know enough about the historical context, and perhaps
it was actually
a bigger problem that there's alcoholism in Appalachia compared to like a fishing village where everyone's just a Methodist.
Maybe. And also, this isn't like, it's very frustrating when you read books about like, oh, I don't think she's saying this, but you often read books about like, oh, those dumb hillbillies, you know, like they don't have, like, you know,
right.
And it definitely captures like the poverty and like the isolation that the mountains can bring, but also the way that she talks about the people of the valley is very otherizing in a way.
Well, they
that,
literally
like,
are another because she's
they
coming
are
into their
other,
community.
But like she become again, maybe this is something that could be fleshed out more if it was a longer
right.
book.
Well, and also the fact that we learn nothing about her husband, which could be a really humanizing
right.
element.
And there's this other part where she's talking about, like, this 18-year-old who's pregnant and often beaten. And it doesn't say who she's beaten by, but you would think it's her partner. But then she justifies it, like, well, this partner's really well-meaning, so he's still going to be... I'm just like,
Yeah.
I don't really want to justify, like, domestic violence. And I also don't want us to make an assumption of, like, all these... Like, that this is a... That alcoholism and men beating their wives is like specific to Appalachia, when we know that it's a very bigger issue.
Yeah, there is a little bit of the like
every
the
community.
Like, there's a little bit of like the soft like race science that like
yes.
J.D. Vance uses in Hillbilly Elegy, where it's like she specifically uses the term Scotch Irish, like so she like ethnicizes them and says like oh. Which she never does of her native,
mm-hmm.
which I think is typical of someone coming into a new community. You notice the differences. You notice this is a different subculture than I'm used to. But
right,
like,
you're trying to understand it. You try to think of what's
right.
different about.
But
where
there
I
is
grew.
Kind of the implication that like, oh, these Scotch Irish people are all just drunkards and they all are violent and all. Like, I can see it definitely. It's just so vague. Like it's just a sketch of a plot.
And you don't have
plot.
Time. So I just feel like if you don't have time to really explore that, like don't try because it just kind of felt
it is, like it's
me.
So wild. Like there's so many details that are just thrown at you in the last few pages that feel like that they should be developed and definitely feel like there's the opportunity for, like, there's so much conflict, mm-hmm. like, even just her medical school stuff, where mm-hmm. she's, like, told, sorry, you can't be a doctor, like, that is, in itself, could be a whole mm-hmm. thing, much less, like, her moving to this isolated community.
Yeah, as someone that has felt that they've been told their whole lives, you can't be this thing, because of, you know, like, your sister, but right. now, like, even, not only because you were the firstborn scorned by God, but because you're a woman at all, like, I just think there's so many, like, beautiful, like, rich feminist ideas in this book that I feel like at the end she doesn't get to do anything right. with.
Well, in the,
and let me just clarify, I don't think that Sarah Louise, I'm not saying that, like, she shouldn't have ended up married or having kids or anything like that, like,
We're talking about narrative structure, though.
Yes, yeah. And the last thing I'll say is I really would have liked, she gets a really good scene with her mom, a really good conversation with her mom, but I would have liked to see her relationship with her parents more fleshed out. Like, you don't really feel like they care about her until the end of the book, and maybe this is just part of her coming of age. Like, I didn't realize they cared about me until this point, but I think it really falls flat when it comes to her dad. Like, we get to see, she gets close with her dad because they crab together, but there's not really a lot of scenes of them doing that together. There's, like, one scene where she sees him really in his element singing to the oysters. And, like, his face when he does that is the same look that she sees in her husband when she falls in love with him. And then she ends up naming her son after him, and you're supposed to think that she's got, like, this rich, deep closeness and affection with her father the whole time, but I don't really think we get to see a lot of that in the book.
So, I agree. You mentioned oysters, though, and I just got to go back to mm-hmm. the grandmother, because the one and only time when I related to what the grandmother was saying is when Sarah Louise, so her parents have gone to Caroline's wedding, and Sarah Louise has to stay
Mm-mm.
back. Is it not her wedding?
It's her, maybe it is. It is her wife.
They've gone to visit Caroline regardless, but the grandmother can't travel, so Sarah Louise is like, I'll stay home with the grandmother. And it falls over Thanksgiving. Sarah Louise cooks what she describes as a delicious dinner, but
Christmas,
whatever it is. But the grandmother, like, is disgusted by it, is a chicken stuffed with oysters. And, you know, maybe this is just me being closed-minded, but this is the one and only time in the book I side with the grandmother. Chicken stuffed with oysters sounds terrible to
me. And she's such a little kid about it, too. She's like, take them off my plate. Because they're like, just sit around. And she's like, no, take it off of my plate. The number of times we've had that conversation.
I relate to the grandmother. Anyway, we've been going on for almost over an hour now.
Oh,
so
sorry.
No. I mean, listeners, I don't feel like we should apologize to you. You could have stopped at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Stop
maybe
listening.
Maybe you did.
But just in the interest of not going too much further, any final thoughts before we give our thumbs up or thumbs down?
I just think this is a profound book. And what I will say is one thing that I think is truly beautiful is that Sarah Louise has people in her life to tell her how loved she is and how important and how wanted and how skilled she is. And just to have her hear something different from her grandmother and have these people that she really respects but feels isolated from speak that truth over her, I think is just so important. And I am just very grateful that Katherine Patterson captured that. So, anyway.
Thumbs up for me.
Thumbs up for me.
Shame about the ending, but thumbs up for me.
Yeah.
All right, well, that concludes our discussion of this book. Next time, we're in the 90s. The grungy Clinton era 90s. And we're going to read the 1993 medal winner, which is called Missing May by Cynthia Rylant?
Looks right to me.
I don't know. I've not read this book. Have you?
Nope.
All right. It'll be an adventure. Anyway, don't forget that if you have comments or thoughts for us, or you just want to generally just say, hey, just like Louise or Sarah Louise's mother said that she really appreciated her at the end, we really appreciate you, Newbery Chronicles. You know, if you want to send a message like that, or maybe the opposite, if you want to say you prefer Caroline, you can reach us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com. Newbery with one R. I feel like I always have to correct myself when I'm typing that out. So anyway, I think that's all I got.
Thanks for listening.